wall, and I wished that my fist had weighed a ton. She tried to do something. She pulled my hair and scratched at me. But I had come up fighting with boys. Hair pulling didn't worry me. She screamed that she was going to get Papa's pistol and kill me. She tried to get across the room to the dresser drawer, but I knew I couldn't let that happen. So the fight got hotter. A friend of hers who weighed over 200 pounds lived across the street. She heard the rumpus and came running. I visualized that she would try to grab me, and I realized that my stepmother would get her chance. So I grabbed my stepmother by the collar and dragged her to a hatchet against the wall and managed to get hold of it. As Mrs. G waddled through the living room door, I hollered to her to get back and let fly with that hatchet with all that my right arm would do. It struck the wall too close to her head to make her happy. She reeled around and rolled down those front steps yelling that I had gone crazy. But she never came back and the fight went on. I was so mad when I saw my adversary sagging to the floor, I didn't know what to do. I began to scream with rage. I had not beaten more than 2 years out of her yet. I made up my mind to stomp her. But at last, Papa came too and pulled me away. I had a scratch on my neck and two or three on my arms, but that was all. I was not at all pacified. She owed me 4 more years. Besides, there was her spit on the front of my dress. I promised myself to pay her for the old and the new, too, the first chance I got. Years later, after I had graduated from Barnard and I was doing research, I found out where she was. I drove 20 miles to finish the job, only to find out that she was a chronic invalid. She had an incurable sore on her neck. I couldn't tackle her under such circumstances, so I turned back, all frustrated inside. All I could do was to wish that she had a lot more neck to rot. That fight brought things to a head between Papa and his wife. She said Papa had to have me arrested. But Papa said he didn't have to do but 2 things, die and stay black. And then he would never let me sleep in jail a night. She took the matter to the church, and the people laughed. Most of them had been praying for something like that to happen. They were annoyed because she didn't get her head stomped. The thing rocked on for a few months. She demanded that Papa handle some of the sisters of the church who kept cracking her about it, but he explained that there was nothing he could do. They were old friends of my mother's, and it was natural for them to feel as they did. There were 2 or 3 hot word battles on the church grounds, and then she left Papa with the understanding that he could get her back when he had made them good-for-nothing nigger women's know that she was Mrs. Reverend. So she went on off with her lip hung down lower than a mason's apron. Papa went to see a lawyer, and he said to send her clothes to her if she had not come back after 3 weeks, and that is just what Papa did. She lawed for a divorce, and he let it slide. The black Anne Boleyn had come at last to the mourning and the axe. The simile ends there. The king really had an axe. It has always seemed to me, under the provocation, a sad lack that preachers could not go armed like that. Perhaps it is just as well that it has been arranged so that the state has taken over the business of execution. Not every skunk in the world rates a first-class killing. Hanging is too good for some folks. They just need their behinds kicked, and that is all that woman rated. But, you understand, this was 6 years after I went up to Jacksonville. I put it in right here because I was thinking so hard. But back to Jacksonville and the school. I had gotten used to the grits and gravy for breakfast, had found out how not to be bored at prayer meeting, you could always write notes if you didn't go to sleep, and how to poke fun at acidulated disciplinarians, and how to slip through a crack in the fence and cross the street to the grocery store for ginger snaps and pickles, which were forbidden between meals. I had generally made a sort of adjustment. Lessons had never worried me, though arithmetic still seemed an unnecessary evil. Then, one day, the second in command sent for me to tell me that my room and board had not been paid. What was I going to do about it? I certainly didn't know. Then she gave me a freehand opinion of the Reverend John Hurston that Chief Justice Taney could not have surpassed. Every few days after that, I was called in and asked what was I going to do. After a while, she did not call me in. She would just yell out of the window to where I might be playing in the yard. That used to keep me shrunk up inside. I got so I wouldn't play too hard. The call might come at any time. My spirits would not have quite so far to fall. But I stayed out the year, but not because my bills were paid. I was put to scrubbing down the stair steps every Saturday and sent to help clean up the pantry and do what I could in the kitchen after school. Then, too, the city of Jacksonville had a spelling bee in all the Negro schools, and I won it for my school. I received an Atlas of the World and a Bible as prizes, besides so much lemonade and cake that I told President Collier that I could feel it coming through my skin. He had such a big laugh that I made up my mind to hurry up and get grown and marry him. For his part, he didn't seem to know that he had been picked out. In fact, he seemed to be quite patient about it, never tried to hurry my growth at all, and never mentioned the matter. He acted like he was satisfied with some stale old decrepit woman of 25 or so. It used to drive me mad. I comforted myself with the thought that he would cry his eyes out when I would suddenly appear before him, tall and beautiful and disdainful, and make him beg me for a whole week before I would give in and marry him. And of course, fire all of those old half-dead teachers who were hanging around him. Maybe they would drown themselves in the St. John's River. Oh, I might stop them just before they jumped in. I never did decide what to do with all my disgruntled rivals after I dragged them away from the river. They could rake up the yard, but a yard somewhere a long way from where he was. That would be better for everybody. A yard in Africa would be just dandy. They would naturally die of old age in a week or so. I wrote some letters from him to me and read his tender words with tears in my eyes. I made us a secret post office behind the laundry. One day, his letters to me would get written and buried, and the next day, I would dig them up and read them. Then I would answer them and assure him he did not have to worry. I meant to marry him as soon as they let me put on long dresses, which I hoped would not be too far off. A month or two more ought to age me quite a bit. This torrid love affair was conducted from a hole in the ground behind the laundry and came to an abrupt end. One of those same hateful teachers who was mean enough to get grown before I did reported to my husband in reserve that it was I who had put a wet brick in her bed while she was presiding over study hour in the chapel. So much fuss over nothing. Just a brick that had been soaked overnight in a rain barrel placed between the sheets near the foot of the bed, and they made as much fuss about it as if ice cream had been abolished. It was true that it was a coldish spell of weather in February and all that. But what fun would a cold brick be in June, I ask you? Oh, the perfidy. The deceit of the man to whom I had given my love and all my lovely letters in the hole behind the laundry. He listened to this unholy female and took me into his office and closed the door. He did not fold me lovingly in his arms and say, "Darling, I understand. You did it all for me." No. The blind fool lifted up my skirt in the rear and spanked a prospective tall, beautiful lady's pants. So improper, to say the least. I made up my mind to get even. I wouldn't marry him now, no matter how hard he begged me. Insult me, would he? Turning up my dress just like I was some child? Ah, he would pine for my love and never get it. In addition to letting him starve for my love, I was going off and die in a pitiful way. Very lonely and dramatic at the same time, however. The whole thing was so unjust. She did not see me put that brick in her bed. And if the duty girl did look back over her shoulder and see me coming down the hall with the brick in my hand, what kind of decent person is that? Going around and looking backwards at people. When I would be grown and sit up in my fine palace eating beef stew and fried chicken, that duty girl was going to be out in my backyard gnawing doorknobs. Time passed. Spring came up the St. John's River from down the Everglades way, and school closed in a blaze of programs, cantatas, and speeches, and trunks went bumping downstairs. My brother hurried off to take a job. I was to stay there, and Papa would send for me. I kept looking out of the window so that I could see Papa when he came up the walk to the office. But nobody came for me. Weeks passed, and then a letter came. Papa said that the school could adopt me. The second in command sent for me and told me about it. She said that she had no place for a girl so young, and besides, she was too busy to bring up any children. It was crumbling news for me. It impressed every detail of the office and her person on my mind. I noted more clearly than ever the thick gray-black ropes of her half-Negro, half-white hair, her thin lips and white folks-looking nose. All in all, her yellow skin, browned down by age, looked like it had been dried between the leaves of a book. I had always been afraid of her sharp tongue and quick hand, but this day she seemed to speak a little softer than usual, and in half-finished sentences, as if she had her tender parts to hide. She took out her purse and handed me some money. She was going to pay my way home by the boat, and I must tell my father to send her dollar and a half. The boat trip was thrilling on the side-wheeler city of Jacksonville. The water life, the smothering foliage that draped the river banks, the miles of purple hyacinths, all thrilled me anew. The wild thing was back in the jungle. The curtain of trees along the river shut out the world so that it seemed that the river and the chugging boat was all that there was, and that pleased me a lot. Inside, the boat was glittering with shiny brass. White-clad waiters dashed about with trays for the first class upstairs. There was an almost ceaseless rattle of dishes, red carpet underfoot, big, shiny lights overhead, white men in greasy overalls popping up from down below now and then to lean on the deck rail for a breath of air. A mulatto waiter with a patch over one eye who kept bringing me slabs of pie and cake and chicken and steak sandwiches and sent me astern to eat them. Things clattered up the gangplank, and then more things rumbled down into the hold. People on the flimsy docks waving goodbye to anybody who wanted to wave back. Wild hogs appearing now and then along the shore. Gators disturbed by the wash, slipping off of palm logs into the stream. Schools of mullet breaking water now and then. Flocks of waterfowl disturbed at the approach of the steamer, then settling back again to feed. Catfish as long as a man pacing the boat like porpoises for kitchen scraps. A group of turpentine hands with queer haircuts in blue overalls with red handkerchiefs around their necks who huddled around a tall black man with a guitar around his neck. They ate out of shoeboxes and sang between drinks out of a common bottle. A stocking-foot woman was with them, with a dirk in her garter. Her new shoes were in a basket beside her. She dipped snuff and kept missing the spittoon. The glitter of brass and the red carpet made her nervous. The captain kept passing through and pulling my hair gently and asking me to spell something, and kept being surprised when I did. He called out, "Separate," when I was getting off at Sanford, and I spelled it back at him as I went down the gangplank. I left him leaning on the rail and looking like he had some more words he wanted spelled. Then he threw a half dollar that fell just ahead of me and smiled goodbye. The day after I started from Jacksonville, the boat docked at Sanford, with the town of Enterprise a shadowy suspicion across the 5 miles of Lake Monroe. I had to go to the railroad station to take the train for the 15 miles to Maitland. The conductor and the whole crew knew me from seeing me with my father so often. They remembered me for another reason, too, which embarrassed me a lot. This very train and crew had been my first experience with railroads. I had seen trains often, but never up so close as that day about 4 years before, when Papa had decided to take me up to Sanford with him. Then I was at the station with Papa and my two oldest brothers. We heard the train blow, leaving Winter Park 3 miles south, so we picked up our things and moved down from the platform to a spot beside the track. The train came thundering around Lake Lily and snorted up to the station. I was there looking the thing dead in the face, and it was fixing its one big, mean-looking eye on me. It looked fit to gnaw me right up. It was truly a most fearsome thing. The porter swung down and dropped his stool. The conductor in his eyeglasses stood down, changing greetings with Papa. Mr. Westcott, the station agent, and all of the others whom he knew from long association. "All aboard!" The train only hesitated at Maitland. It didn't really stop. This thing was bad, but I saw a chance to save myself yet and still. It did not just have to get me if I moved fast enough. My father swung up to the platform and turned around. My brother Bob had me by the hand and prepared to hand me up. This was the last safe moment I had. I tore loose from Bob and dashed under the train and out again. I was going home. Everybody yelled, the conductor louder than anybody else. "Catcher, head off over there!" The engineer held down his whistle. The fireman jumped off and took after me. Everybody was after me. It looked as if the whole world had turned into my enemies. I didn't have a friend to my name. "There she goes! Him up! Head off from that barbed wire fence!" My own big brother was chasing me as hard as anybody else. My legs were getting tired and I was winded, but I was running for my life. Brother Bob headed me off from home, so I doubled back into Galloway's store and ran behind the counter. Old Harry, Galloway's son, about Bob's age, grabbed me and pulled me out. I was hauled on board, kicking and screaming to the huge amusement of everybody but me. As soon as I saw the glamour of the plush and metal of the inside of that coach, I calmed down. The conductor gave the engineer the highball, and the train rolled. It didn't hurt a bit. Papa laughed and laughed. The porter passed through holding his sides. The conductor came to take Papa's ticket and kept on teasing me about hurting the train's feelings. In a little while, he was back with a glass pistol filled with candy. By the time I got to Sanford, I was crazy about the train. I just wished they would quit laughing at me. The inside of that train was too pretty for words. It took years for me to get over loving it. So when I climbed on board that morning, some 4 years later, I had that look of, "Get away from me, porter. Don't you see I'm too big to be helped on trains?" They all smiled in memory of our first meeting and let it go at that. The porter was a member of Papa's church in Sanford and sat beside me when he was not busy. So I came back to my father's house, which was no longer home. The very walls were gummy with gloom. Too much went on to take the task of telling it. Papa's children were in his way because they were too much trouble to his wife. Ragged, dirty clothes, and hit-and-miss meals. The four older children were definitely gone for good. One by one, we four younger ones were shifted to the homes of Mama's friends. Perhaps it could be no other way. Certainly no other way was open to a man who loved peace and ease the way my father did. My stepmother was sleeping in Mama's feather bed, the one thing which Mama had brought from her father's house. She had said it must be mine. To see this interloper piled up in my mother's bed was too much for me to bear. I had to do something. The others had been miserable about it all along. I rallied my brother Joel to my aid, and we took the mattress off of the bed. Papa had told her that it was his, so he was faced with a dilemma. I stood my ground, and the other children present backed me. She thought a good beating for me ought to settle the ownership once and for all. John took my part. He was always doing that. Dear John, and physical violence, yes, actual bloodshed seemed inevitable for a moment. John and Papa stood face to face, and Papa had an open knife in his hand. Then he looked his defiant son in the eyes and dropped his hand. He just told John to leave home. However, my stepmother had lost her point. She never was pleasured to rack her bones on Mama's feather bed again. Though there were plenty of beds for her to sleep in, she hated to take any dictation at all from us, especially me. But Papa's shoulders began to get tired. He didn't rear back and strut like he used to. His well-cut broadcloth, Stetson hats, handmade alligator skin shoes and walking stick had earned him the title of Big Nigger with his children. Behind his back, of course. He didn't put and take with his cane anymore. He just walked along. It didn't take him near so long to put on his hat. So my second vision picture came to be. I had seen myself homeless and uncared for. There was a chill about that picture which used to wake me up shivering. I had always thought I would be in some lone Arctic wasteland with no one under the sound of my voice. I found the cold, the desolate solitude and earless silences, but I discovered that all that geography was within me. It only needed time to reveal it. My vagrancy had begun. In reality, I knew that. There was an end to my journey, and it had happiness in it for me. It was certain and sure. But the way, its agony was equally certain. It was before me, and no one could spare me my pilgrimage. The rod of compelment was laid to my back. I must go the way. Chapter 8. Backstage and the Railroad. There is something about poverty that smells like death. Dead dreams dropping off the heart like leaves in a dry season and rotting around the feet. Impulses smothered too long in the fetid air of underground caves. The soul lives in a sickly air. People can be slave ships in shoes. This wordless feeling went with me from the time I was 10 years old until I achieved a sort of competence around 20. Naturally, the first 5 years were the worst. Things and circumstances gave life a most depressing odor. The 5 years following my leaving the school at Jacksonville were haunted. I was shifted from house to house of relatives and friends and found comfort nowhere. I was without books to read most of the time, except where I could get hold of them by mere chance. That left no room for selection. I was miserable, and no doubt made others miserable around me, because they could not see what was the matter with me, and I had no part in what interested them. I was in school off and on, which gave me vagrant peeps into the light, but these intervals lacked peace because I had no guarantee that they would last. I was growing, and the general thought was that I could bring in something. This book-reading business was a holdback and an unrelieved evil. I could not do very much, but look at so-and-so. She was nursing for some good white people. A dollar a week and most of her clothes. People who had no parents could not afford to sit around on school benches, wearing out what clothes they had. One of the most serious objections to me was that having nothing, I still did not know how to be humble. A child in my place ought to realize I was lucky to have a roof over my head and anything to eat at all. And from their point of view, they were right. From mine, my stomach pains were the least of my sufferings. I wanted what they could not conceive of. I could not reveal myself for lack of expression and then for lack of hope of understanding. Even if I could have found the words, I was not comfortable to have around. Strange things must have looked out of my eyes like Lazarus after his resurrection. So I was forever shifting. I walked by my corpse. I smelt it and felt it. I smelt the corpses of those among whom I must live, though they did not. They were as much at home with theirs as death in a tomb. Gradually, I came to the point of attempting self-support. It was a glorious feeling when it came to me. But the actual working out of the thing was not so simple as the concept. I was about 14 then. For one thing, I really was young for the try. Then my growth was retarded somewhat, so that I looked younger than I really was. Housewives would open the door at my ring and look me over. No, they wanted someone old enough to be responsible. No, they wanted someone strong enough to do the work and so on like that. Did my mother know I was out looking for work? Sometimes in bed at night I would ask myself that very question and wonder. But now and then someone would like my looks and give me a try. I did very badly because I was interested in the front of the house, not the back. No matter how I resolved, I'd get tangled up with their reading matter and lose my job. It was not that I was lazy. I just was not interested in dusting and dishwashing. But I always made friends with the children, if there were any. That was not intentional. We just got together somehow. That would be fun, but going out to play did not help much on jobs. One woman liked me for it. She had two little girls, 7 and 5. I was hired as an upstairs maid. For 2 or 3 days, things went on very well. The president of the kitchen was a fat, black old woman who had nursed the master of the house and was a fixture. Nobody is so powerful in a southern family as one of these family fixtures. No matter who hires you, the fixture can fire you. They roam all over the house, bossing everybody from the boss on down. Nobody must upset Cynthia or Rhoda or Becky. If you can't get along with the house president, you can't keep the job. And Miss Callie was president in full in this house. She looked at me cut-eye first thing because the madam had hired me without asking her about it. She went into her grumble just as soon as I stuck my head in the kitchen door. She looked at me for a moment with her hands on her hips and burst out, Lord of mercy, Miss Alice must done took you to raise. She don't need no more youngers round the place. This house needs a woman to give aid and assistance. She showed her further disapproval by vetoing every move I made. She was to show me where to find the aprons, and she did. Just as soon as I pulled open the drawer, she bustled me right away from it with her hips. Don't you go pulling and hauling through my drawers. I keeps things in they place. You take the apron I give you and get on up them stairs. I didn't get mad with her. I took the apron and put it on with quite a bit of editing by Sister Callie and went on up the back stairs. As I emerged on the upper floor, two pairs of gray-blue eyes were ranged on me.
Hello,
said the two little girls in chorus.
Hello,
I answered back.
You going to work for us?
The taller one asked and fell in beside me. Yeah. Maybe I cracked a smile or something, for both of them took a hand on either side, and we went on into the room where Mrs. Alice was waiting for me to show me what to do and how to do it. She was a very beautiful woman in her middle 20s, and she was combing out her magnificent hair. She looked at me through the looking glass, and we both started to grinning for some reason or another. She showed me how to make beds and clean up. There were three rooms up there, but she told me not to try to do too much at a time. Just keep things looking sort of neat. Then she dressed and left the house. I got things straightened out with Helen and Genevieve acting as convoy at every step. Things went all right till I got to the bathroom. Then, somehow or other, we three found ourselves in a tussle. Screaming, laughing, splashing water, and tussling, when a dark shadow filled up the door. Hines could have wrung enough vinegar out of Callie's look to run his pickle works. "You going away from here," she prophesied, and shook her head so vigorously that her head rag wagged. She was going to get me gone from there.
"No,"
screamed Helen, the littlest girl, and held on to me.
"No, no, no,"
Genevieve shrieked. "Huh, you just wait till your daddy come home," Callie gloomed. "I ain't never seen no sich caper like this since I been born in this world." Then she stumped on back downstairs.
"Don't you go," Genevieve begged. "I like you." "Me too. I like you too," Helen chorused. "If you go home, we'll go with you."
I had to wait on the table at dinner that night, with my apron too long for me. Mrs. Alice and the children were giving a glowing account of me. The boss glanced at me tolerantly a time or two. Helen would grab hold of my clothes every time I passed her chair and play in the vegetable dishes when I offered them to her, until her father threatened to spank her hands, but he looked up at me and smiled a little. He looked to me like an aged old soul of 35 or so. Callie kept on cracking the kitchen door to see how I was getting along in there, and I suspect to give the boss a view of her disapproving face. Things rocked on for a week or two. Mrs. Alice went out more and more to bridge clubs and things like that. She didn't care whether I made up the rooms or not, so long as the children were entertained. She would come in late in the afternoon and tell Callie to run upstairs and straighten up a bit. "What's that gal been doing?" Callie would growl. That gal she was talking about had been off to the park with the children, or stretched out on the floor telling stories, or reading aloud from some of their storybooks. Their mother had been free to go about her business, and a good time was had by all, except Callie. Before a month passed, things came to a head. Callie burst into the dining room one night and flew all over the place. The boss had to get somebody to do his cooking. She was tired of doing all the work. She just wasn't going to cook and look after things downstairs and then troop upstairs and do the work somebody else was getting paid for. She was old. Her joints hurt her so bad till she couldn't rest of nights. They really needed to get somebody to help. Mrs. Alice sat there stark, still and quiet. The boss looked at her, then at old Callie, and then at me. Finally, he said,
"I never meant for you to work yourself down like that, Aunt Callie. You've done more than your share."
"'Deed God knows I is," Callie agreed belligerently, rolling her white eyeballs in my direction.
"Isn't Zora taking care of the upstairs? I thought that was what she was hired for,"
the boss asked and looked at his wife.
"Taking care of what?" Callie snorted. "'Deed I ain't lying, Mr. Ed. I wouldn't tell a lie on nobody."
"I know you wouldn't, Auntie," he soothed. "That gal don't do a living thing round this house, but play all day long with these youngins. Then I has to scuffle up them stairs and do round, 'cause if and I didn't, this here place would be like a hog pen. That's what it would. I has to go and do it, Mr. Ed, else it wouldn't never get done. And I'm sick and tired. I'm going away from here."
"No, Callie, you can't do it. You've been with me all my life, and I don't aim to let you go. Zora will have to go. These children are too big now to need a nurse."
What did he say that for? My public went into sound and action. Mrs. Alice was letting a tear or two slip. Otherwise, she was as still as stone. But Helen scrambled out of her chair, with her jaws latched back to the last notch. She stumbled up against me and swung on. Genevieve screamed, "No!" in a regular chant like a cheerleader, and ran to me too. Their mother never raised her head. The boss turned to her.
"Darling, why don't you quiet these children?" he asked gently.
"No, no, no! Zora can't go!"
my cheering squad yelled, slinging tears right and left.
"Shut up!"
the boss grated at the children and put his hand on the table and scuffled his feet as if he meant to rush off for the hairbrush.
"I'll be on you in one more minute. Hush!"
It was easy to see that his heart was not in any spanking. His frown was not right for it. The yelling kept right on. Callie flounced on back to the kitchen, and he got up and hauled the children upstairs. In a minute, he called his wife and shut the bedroom door. I cleared off the table, and when I sat down in the kitchen to eat, Callie slammed a plate in front of me with some dried-up fried eggs left from breakfast. She put the steak away in the icebox ostentatiously, just daring me with her eyes to cheep about it. I kept good and quiet. In about a half hour, the boss came down and talked to Callie. I was to stay on and look after the children. His wife was going to look around for a woman to take care of the upstairs and the front of the house, too. Callie would have less to do. He sort of apologized when he said the children were so attached to me that he hated to get rid of me on their account. Not once did he say a word to me. So Callie was mollified to an extent. If she had not gotten rid of me, her rank had been recognized at any rate. That was what she was fighting for anyway. He told her to go down to a certain shoe store the next day and tell them to let her have some more comfortable shoes and send the bill to him. Then he went back upstairs very quietly. Callie talked to me then and gave me a piece of pie. But that was not the end. I could sense that my being there was doing something to that house. There were looks between husband and wife at times. He was not satisfied, and it was not the $2 a week I was getting. He was not mean to me, he just acted funny. His wife was as good as gold. She made me a white dress herself and bought me a Sunday hat. She would go out to her bridge clubs and things like that, but she was usually home before he got there. Sometimes she would be home before the children and I got home from our prowls, and how we did prowl. Then the boss took to coming home at odd hours and going in the kitchen and talking to Callie for a long time. One evening, he just fired me suddenly after the children had been put to bed. I hated it because I was having all the fun in the world. He had followed me down to the foot of the stairs. While he was paying me off, Mrs. Alice came out of her room and stood at the top of the stairs. "Ed," she began.
"Now you go on back in your room, Alice. I'm handling this. Go on. You don't need Zora to take care of those children. She is not going to be here another day. I mean that."
He saw me out of the door, and I went off feeling sad. I didn't know what he was firing me for. The children were more than satisfied with my company. His wife seemed very glad to have me around. I couldn't see what was wrong. Years later, when I had seen more, I concluded that he was jealous of his wife. He was not one of those pretty men, and she was a beautiful thing, much younger than he was. I do not think that she ever did anything wrong, but he felt insecure. If she had to be around to keep up with the children, she had her hands full. There was much less danger of her wandering off. Callie was in his confidence. I am certain that he got full reports on his wife's goings and comings. He loved his wife dearly, and he was afraid his miracle might fade. She had told me herself that she had married at 17. She was certainly a lovely, soft-looking thing. She never wore the things people didn't want to look at, and she did wear things you always wanted to see. And she had an easy kind of sweet smell. A lot of men would have taken over the job of worrying with her at the drop of a hat. Well, then, I didn't have a job anymore. I didn't have money either, but I had bought a pair of shoes. But I was lucky, in a way. Somebody told the woman I was staying with about another job, so I went to see about it, and the lady took me. She was sick in the bed, and she had a little girl 3 years old. But this child did not shine like Helen and Genevieve. She was sort of old-looking in the face. I didn't like that house. It frowned at me just as soon as I crossed the door sill. It was a big house with plenty of things in it, but the rooms just sat across the hall from each other and made gloomy faces back and forth. The sick lady was named Mrs. Moncrief, and she had two older sisters who had never been married, and they gloomed. The cook was an old family relic on the female side, and she was out of the habit of smiling, too. Mr. Moncrief used to laugh, but not around the house, and it was no good laugh when he did it. The reason I knew was, about a week after I joined up, he took to waylaying me down the street a piece and walking with me. It made me feel very uncomfortable for him to do that. I didn't see what he wanted to do it for anyway. It was not long before he told me he was sick and tired of that house full of sour-looking women. He was sick of the town and everything in it. He was selling out his business and going away. He would take me to Canada with him if I wanted to go, and if I had any sense, I would jump at the chance. I kept telling him I didn't want to go. I did want to go someplace else, but not with him. It sounded grand if he would just pay my way up there and he go someplace else. His belly laid all over his belt, and he was so chuckle-headed that you couldn't see his collar. But he didn't seem to have but one ear, and it couldn't hear a thing but yes. So every morning, I hated to go back to that house, but I hated more to go home at night. Finally, I got over being timid of his being the boss and just told him not to bother me. He laughed at that. Then I said that I would tell his wife, and he laughed again. The very next night, he was waiting for me. So I went in and told his wife to make him stop waylaying me. I did not tell her about Canada. I needn't worry about that. I just wanted him to stop making me feel shame by walking along with me. People might talk. Right then, I learned a lesson to carry with me through life. I'll never tell another wife. She laid there a long time and said nothing. Then she tried to smile as if it were a joke that was mildly funny. Then she began to cry, without moving anything in her face. It was terrible to look at, and I wanted to run out of there and hide and never let anybody see me again. But it was hard to move my feet, so I began to cry too. She shook her head and said, "You have nothing to cry about, Zora. You haven't been lying here for 3 years with somebody hoping to find you dead every morning. You don't know what it means for every girl who comes in hailing distance to be mixed up in your life. You don't know what it means to give birth to a child for your husband and find that your health is gone the day the baby is born and for him not to care what becomes of the baby or you either. God, why couldn't he leave you alone?" I saw her fumbling for the glass of water on the bed table, so I handed it to her and ran out of the house. I felt lower than sea bottom. I ran off so that I could cry alone. I never meant to foot that house again, nor to see anybody who lived in it. But the next day, around 9 o'clock, he drove up to where I lived.
"So you told on me, did you?"
He opened right up, and I thought that he was going to kill me then and there. "I told you if you didn't leave me alone, I was going to tell," I quavered.
"Oh, that is all right, girlie. She's not my boss. She hasn't a thing to do with our business. It's you and me going to Canada, not that old maid I married by mistake. When can you be ready?"
That was too much. He was not even listening to what I had to say. I gave up and told him I could be ready on Saturday.
"That's 3 days off," he objected. "You can't have all that getting ready to do. How about tomorrow night?"
"Well, all right, tomorrow night," I lied.
"Meet me at the station. You don't need your clothes. I'll buy you something decent to wear on the way. Just be there. Nope. You better stay here. I'll come get you. Don't you fool me now. Just be there. I'm not the kind of a man that stands for no fooling. I'm not the kind of man to be worried with so much responsibilities. Never should have let myself get married in the first place. All I need is a young, full-of-feelings girl to sleep with and enjoy life. I always did keep me a colored girl. My last one moved off to Chicago and sort of left me without. I want a colored girl, and I'm giving you the preference."
He went on down the steps, and I ran inside to pack up my few things. In an hour, I had moved. He came for me the next night, I was told, and tried to search the house to see if the landlady had tried to block him by telling a lie. He could not conceive of my not wanting to go with him. 2 weeks later, it was in the papers that he had taken all of his own money that he could get his hands on, and some other people's money, and had vanished. Nobody seemed to know which way he went. The Black Dispatch, Negro Grapevine, reported that the colored office girl of a well-known white doctor had gone with him. I never tried to give any information. I felt that my big mouth had worked overtime as it was. I never even went back to get my pay. I was out of a job again. I got out of many more. Sometimes I didn't suit the people. Sometimes the people didn't suit me. Sometimes my insides tortured me so that I was restless and unstable. I just was not the type. I was doing none of the things I wanted to do. I had to do numerous uninteresting things I did not want to do, and it was tearing me to pieces. I wanted family love and peace and a resting place. I wanted books and school. When I saw more fortunate people of my own age on their way to and from school, I would cry inside and be depressed for days until I learned how to mash down on my feelings and numb them for a spell. I felt crowded in on, and hope was beginning to waver. The third vision of aimless wandering was on me as I had seen it. My brother Dick had married and sent for me to come to Sanford and stay with him. I got hopeful for school again. He sent me a ticket and I went. I didn't want to go, though. As soon as I got back to Sanford, my father ordered me to stay at his house. It was no more than a month after I got there before my stepmother and I had our fight. I found my father a changed person. The bounce was gone from the man. The wreck of his home and the public reaction to it was telling on him. In spite of all, I was sorry for him, and that added to my resentment towards his wife. In all fairness to her, she probably did the best she could, according to her lights. It was just tragic that her light was so poor. A little more sense would have told her that the time and manner of her marriage to my father had killed any hope of success from the start. No warning bell inside of her caused her to question the wisdom of an arrangement made over so many fundamental stumbling stones. My father certainly could not see the consequences, for he had never had to consider them too seriously. Mama had always been there to do that. Suddenly he must have realized with inward terror that Lucy was not there anymore. This was not just another escapade which Mama would maul his knit for in private and smooth out publicly. It had rushed him along to where he did not want to go already, and the end was not in sight. This new wife had wormed her way out of her little crack in the world to become what looked to her like a great lady, and the big river was too much for her craft. Instead of the world dipping the knee to the new-made Mrs. Reverend, they were spitting on her intentions and calling her a storm buzzard. Certainly if my father had not built up a strong following years before, he could not have lasted 3 months. As it was, his foundations rotted from under him, and 7 years saw him wrecked. He did not defend her and establish her. It might have been because he was not the kind of a man who could live without his friends, and his old friends, male and female, were the very ones who were leading the attack to disestablish her. Then, too, a certain amount of the prestige every wife enjoys arises out of where the man got her from and how. She lacked the comfort of these bulwarks, too. She must have decided that if she could destroy his children, she would be safe. But the opposite course would have been the only extenuating circumstance in the eyes of the public. The failure of the project would have been obvious in a few months or even weeks if Papa had been the kind of man to meet the conflict with courage. As it was, the misery of the situation continued for years. He was dragging around like a stepped-on worm. My brief appearance on the scene acted like a catalyzer. A few more months, and the thing fell to pieces for good. I could not bear the air for miles around. It was too personal and pressing, and humid with memories of what used to be. So I went off to another town to find work. It was the same as at home so far as the dreariness and lack of hope and blunted impulses were concerned. But one thing did happen that lifted me up. In a pile of rubbish, I found a copy of Milton's Complete Works. The back was gone and the book was yellowed, but it was all there. So I read Paradise Lost and luxuriated in Milton's syllables and rhythms without ever having heard that Milton was one of the greatest poets of the world. I read it because I liked it. I worked through the whole volume and then I put it among my things. When I was supposed to be looking for work, I would be stretched out somewhere in the woods, reading slowly, so that I could understand the words. Some of them I did not, but I had read so many books that my reading vocabulary at least was not too meager. A young woman who wanted to go off on a trip asked me to hold down her job for 2 months. She worked in a doctor's office, and all I had to do was to answer the telephone and do around a little. The doctor thought that I would not be suitable at first, but he had to have somebody right away. So he took a deep breath and said he'd try me. We got along just very well indeed after the first day. I became so interested and useful that he said if his old girl did not come back when she promised, he was going to see to it that I was trained for a practical nurse when I was a bit older. But just at that time, I received a letter from Bob, my oldest brother. He had just graduated from medicine and said that he wanted to help me go to school. He was sending for me to come to him right away. His wife sent love. He knew that I was going to love his children. He had married in his freshman year in college and had three of them. Nothing can describe my joy. I was going to have a home again. I was going to school. I was going to be with my brother. He had remembered me at last. My five haunted years were over. I shall never forget the exaltation of my hurried packing. When I got on the train, I said goodbye, not to anybody in particular, but to the town, to loneliness, to defeat and frustration, to shabby living, to sterile houses and numbed pangs, to the kind of people I had no wish to know, to an era. I waved it goodbye and sank back into the cushions of the seat. It was near night. I shall never forget how the red ball of the sun hung on the horizon and raced along with the train for a short space, and then plunged below the belly band of the earth. There have been other suns that set in significance for me, but that sun, it was a bookmark in the pages of a life. I remember the long, strung-out cloud that measured it for the fall. But I was due for more frustration. There was to be no school for me right away. I was needed around the house. My brother took me for a walk and explained to me that it would cause trouble if he put me in school at once. His wife would feel that he was pampering me. Just work along and be useful around the house, and he would work things out in time. This did not make me happy at all. I wanted to get through high school. I had a way of life inside me, and I wanted it with a want that was twisting me. And now, it seemed, I was just as far off as before. I was not even going to get paid for working this time, and no time off. But on the other hand, I was with my beloved brother, and the children were adorable. I was soon wrapped up in them head over heels. It was get up early in the morning and make a fire in the kitchen range. Don't make too much noise and wake up my sister-in-law. I must remember that she was a mother and needed the rest. She had borne my brother's children and deserved the best that he could do for her, and so on. It didn't sound just right. I was not the father of those children, and several months later I found out what was wrong. It came to me in a flash. She had never borne a child for me, so I did not owe her a thing. Maybe somebody did, but it certainly wasn't I. My brother was acting as if I were the father of those children instead of himself. There was much more, but my brother is dead, and I do not wish to even risk being unjust to his memory or unkind to the living. My sister-in-law is one of the most devoted mothers in the world. She was brave and loyal to my brother when it took courage to be that way. After all, she was married to him, not I. But I made an unexpected friend. She was a white woman and poor. She had children of my own age. Her husband was an electrician. She began to take an interest in me and to put ideas in my head. I will not go so far as to say that I was poorly dressed, for that would be bragging. The best I can say is that I could not be arrested for indecent exposure. I remember wanting gloves. I had never had a pair, and one of my friends told me that I ought to have on gloves when I went anywhere. I could not have them, and I was most unhappy. But then, I was not in a position to buy a handkerchief. This friend slipped me a message one day to come to her house. We had a code. Her son would pass and whistle until I showed myself to let him know I heard. Then he would go on, and as soon as I could, I would follow. This particular day, she told me that she had a job for me. I was delighted beyond words. "It's a swell job if you can get it, Zora. I think you can,"